It's Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast for the week ending March 12th. This is podcast number 78. For links to earlier podcasts, go to podcasts.jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. Welcome. We've got an overview of what kinds of drug studies are being published in the top journals, a kind of satellite overview that was published this week in JAMA. It may change the way you approach your medical reading. News first. Arguably, the big clinical news this week comes from the UK, where Lancet and Lancet Neurology published what will probably come to be called the Rothwell hypothesis, after Peter Rothwell, who wrote or co-wrote four articles pointing out that the goal of lowering cardiovascular risk and hypertension should not be merely reducing blood pressure, but rather reducing its variability between visits. Stroke risks, Rothwell found, were significantly lower among patients with lower between-visit variation in blood pressure, and that was associated more with use of calcium channel blockers. Beta blockers, on the other hand, seemed to increase variability and hence risk. Next, a New England Journal of Medicine study finds that elective coronary angiography has a low diagnostic yield. A study in close to 500,000 patients suspected of having coronary disease found that only about 38% had significant obstructive disease, and another 39% had no coronary disease at all. Patients with a positive result on a non-invasive test beforehand were moderately more likely to have a positive finding on catheterization. But the authors conclude that there needs to be substantial improvement in the current criteria for catheterization. Finally this week, a study in the Archives of Internal Medicine reports that, not surprisingly, people with prostate cancer who consult with radiologists tend to get radiation, and those who consult with urologists tend to get radical prostatectomies. A strongly worded editorial is critical of what the author calls the prostate cancer treatment bazaar, and he recommends that primary care physicians, who are rarely consulted between diagnosis and the start of therapy, be brought into the decision-making process. He says that patients should be offered more than just a marketing pitch in these circumstances. Next week's interview is scheduled to be with the authors of that research, so listen in. That's it for the news. Let's go on to this week's interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. JAMA this week published a kind of high-level exploration, like a rough map of drug research as published by the top six journals of general medicine. The explorers wandered around the contents of some 300 randomized trials, observational studies, and meta-analyses of drug therapy. Their hope was to classify broadly the characteristics of the research, and in particular to examine very closely the papers studying comparative effectiveness of drug therapies, who the sponsors were, and what their focus was. We have one of those intrepid explorers with us as our guest this week. Dr. Michael Hockman last visited with us about a year and a half ago to discuss his paper on how the news media covered drug research. In those days, Clinical Conversations was called Admitting Diagnosis. Dr. Hockman is now at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, where he is an assistant professor of clinical medicine. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask, first of all, why the sudden national interest in comparative effectiveness studies?
Well, I guess the first thing I would try to explain is what we mean by comparative effectiveness research, because it's a little bit of a jargony term that gets thrown around. Mm-hmm. Basically, in a nutshell, what we mean when we talk about it is research on existing therapies and strategies and diagnostic tests, as opposed to research aimed at developing novel and potentially marketable new technologies and services. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot of the recent national interest in comparative effectiveness research stems from an increasing recognition that maybe we're not practicing medicine in the most efficient way possible, and a large part of the reason is because we actually don't know how to use the existing technologies and therapies that we have in the most efficient way.
There was a study this week in, I think it was Archives, maybe it was JAMA, about prostate cancer. And one of the points made in the study was that, you know, you go to a radiologist for a consultation, you get radiation. You go to a surgeon for a consultation, you get surgery. And no one's really explored closely the comparative effectiveness of those therapies are. Your study was about drugs. And so, as you said, what comparative effectiveness studies do is they concentrate on existing therapies and not so much or not at all on new molecules, right? Just to review that.
That's correct.
Okay. And you looked at about 300 papers on drug research in the top six journals, like, you know, JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, BMJ, Annals, and Archives.
Archives.
Okay. And about a third of them were comparative effectiveness studies, some more so in some journals than in others. Do you think there should be more or should have been more comparative effectiveness studies?
I do. I think people could potentially react to that in different ways. Some people could say, gee, we've been hearing that there's this huge need for comparative effectiveness research, and you guys found that 32% of all studies qualify as comparative effectiveness studies. But when you actually really think about it, the fact that only 32% of medical research, or at least with regards to medications, is geared towards helping doctors better use existing medications as opposed to focusing on mainly the development of new therapies, that does seem like a pretty small number. And as more and more new therapies become available, it certainly begs the question of whether doctors could get lost in terms of how to use all these new technologies as they are developed.
Mike, are you saying that if only a third are comparative effectiveness studies, then two-thirds are about new molecules?
That's not entirely true, but I would say the large majority of those other studies are. An example of a study that wouldn't be a comparative effectiveness study, which would involve existing therapies, is, for example, there was a study we looked at that was an NIH-funded study that examined the use of a proton pump inhibitor for the treatment of asthma, because as probably a lot of the audience knows, many doctors use proton pump inhibitors to treat asthma, but there's not a lot of evidence for it. So basically, it's used in an off-label manner. And basically, the study was done to test whether this off-label practice is actually effective, and they found that it wasn't. So that is a study that involves existing therapies, but according to the definition we used of comparative effectiveness research, it didn't qualify because it compared a treatment to a placebo group rather than to another active therapy. Mm-hmm. So it's not a perfect correlation, but there's also problems the other way. Some of the studies that we, comparative studies, did involve probably new indications for therapies, off-label indications. All in all, I think our study does suggest that well under half of all research is devoted to helping doctors better use existing therapies.
Are we better off focusing on the drugs that we have now, or are we better pursuing the newer ones? I mean, the fact that the drug companies are paying for research on the newer molecules is, I guess, understandable, because they want new products to market. On the other hand, just doing that, I think you find a flaw in that approach, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. I think both types of research are very important. We obviously need new therapies and new compounds if we're going to advance medical science, but if we're not also doing research that helps us use these new therapies and technologies in an appropriate way and also helps us better use existing technologies, we're going to run into trouble, and I think we already have, as evidenced by the recent healthcare debates and the discussion about the inefficiencies in our current system and the unnecessary treatments that we do. I think the prostate cancer issue is a good example that you raised before. For patients with early stage prostate cancer, there are several different treatments. Surgery, and as you noted, many times when patients go to surgeons, that's what they get, and radiation is another option, and many times when patients get referred there, that's what they get. And another equally reasonable option is watchful waiting, essentially close monitoring. And no one really knows which of those approaches is correct, and a lot of benefit could be obtained by trying to sort that question out. Now, that particular question, I do know there are a number of ongoing studies looking at that, but I do think it highlights the point well.
As you saw those studies, did you think, oh, well, you know, this is how things should be going. Yes, it looks good. Or as you were reading them, you might say, or others might say, as they were reading those studies, gee, you know, you have to be careful if you're going to adopt these results because there's a kind of bias here. Is that what...
Yeah, I think, you know, more the latter. The first thing I would say is our findings weren't incredibly surprising, I don't think, to many experts in the field, certainly not to myself. We sort of did the study because we expected to find this. It was our hypothesis going in that there were going to be these concerns. And I think it just put some numbers to some of these general concerns that people had. But I think it raised several concerns. First, as we talked about before, there probably aren't enough studies looking at existing therapies. But even among the comparative effectiveness studies, there were some deficiencies. And I think the most important of those was that there were not a lot of studies that compared medications with non-pharmacologic therapies, such as surgery or lifestyle interventions. There weren't a lot of studies that compared different medication strategies. So, for example, what's the appropriate hemoglobin A1C target in a patient with diabetes, or what's the appropriate CD4 count to initiate antiretroviral therapy. And these issues are really fundamental to medical decision-making. In contrast, the highest category of types of comparative effectiveness studies were studies that just simply compared medication A versus medication B, which are important, but maybe not as critical as some of those more fundamental types of studies that I spoke about before.
As you looked at some of those studies, you noted in your article that very few of them were about cost effectiveness.
Correct.
And very few were about safety.
Correct.
And the people funding the cost effectiveness studies were almost always non-commercial.
Correct. Well, the first thing I should say, there were only two cost effectiveness analyses in our entire 328 study analysis. Both of those did happen to be funded by non-commercial entities, which I guess one might expect, but it's hard to draw firm conclusions based on a sample size of just two.
Yeah.
So I think the more remarkable finding is just how few of these cost effectiveness analyses are being done.
And the other category that I mentioned was safety.
So I think it was 19% of the comparative effectiveness studies focused on safety. This is not to say that other studies didn't appropriately address safety issues. Perhaps some of them did, but you know, just 19% focused on safety. I actually think, and some of the reaction I've got is that maybe that is an appropriate number. Maybe it's appropriate that most studies should focus on efficacy outcomes and only a minority focus on safety. But I think with the, you know, high-profile Vioxx and Avandia cases recently, where it was pretty clear that not enough attention was paid to safety, I think maybe that 19% number is too small. The other point I would make about the safety bit is that the vast majority, I think it was about 90% of the safety studies were funded at least in part by non-commercial entities. And I think that this is really an important finding because it shows that the pharmaceutical companies just simply aren't focused on safety as one might expect, but yet their products can potentially lead to important safety concerns. And I think that this is a problem.
Yeah. What happens when a clinician listening to this next week is sitting in her office and their favorite drug rep drops by and drops a reprint off on the desk? Given what you know about the shape of how medical research is written, how would you counsel her in looking at that reprint that's been left for her?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because I think the main point is that it's very easy for a drug company to find a new compound and do a randomized trial and compare it to a placebo and show that it has some benefit, even if it's small. What would be much tougher would be for that company to do a large study comparing it to other existing appropriate active therapies and show that it's actually better than these older therapies. So I think one important thing is when we get these drug company studies, we want to see what did the new therapy get compared to, and was it actually better than presumably less expensive existing therapies that have a much longer safety track record. You know, if it's something that's just as good, and even if it's the same cost, taking the cost entirely out of the equation, I would argue that it's always better to use the older therapy for which there's more of a safety record, and we really only should be adopting therapies that are actually better than existing therapies.
Is there a resource, a database of these studies, of good comparative effectiveness studies that you're aware of?
There isn't, and that's actually why we did this inventory, because there is very limited information about existing comparative effectiveness studies. The Federal Coordinating Council on Comparative Effectiveness Research is currently developing such a database as part of the $1.1 billion in funding that's going to come from the American Recovery and Reinvestments Act for this type of research. So hopefully that will be forthcoming.
And what was the name of that organization again?
It's called the Federal Coordinating Council on Comparative Effectiveness Research, and there was actually an excellent editorial in JAMA that accompanied our article by Patrick Conway and Carolyn Clancy, who are very involved with that organization.
I'll put a link to the editorial on the website. So with regard to cost-effectiveness analyses, what are your findings, and what would you recommend, if anything, that would change?
While I do think these studies are very important from an academic perspective, and they're very important for sort of letting doctors know that the treatments and therapies we prescribe actually consume resources, they provide us with that perspective, I don't think we're quite yet at the stage where we should be or even need to be making therapeutic decisions based on cost. In other words, I don't think we need to be rationing healthcare or based on cost-effectiveness analyses. And the reason for this is I think that there's so much waste in the current system that we could save a lot of money simply by cutting out unnecessary and potentially even harmful things that we do to people. And that would save a lot of money without causing any rationing whatsoever. So I think a good example of this would be the vast majority of patients with back pain do not benefit from surgery. Numerous studies have shown that, and yet many patients with back pain continue to get surgery even in situations where they probably won't benefit from it, and we could cut a lot of costs simply by not doing so many of those surgeries. There's many other examples: unnecessary stenting in patients with stable cardiac disease, polypharmacy in patients who really don't need additional medication. So there's I think a lot of this has been highlighted by research from the Dartmouth Health Atlas that has gotten a lot of recent attention in the healthcare debates.
Okay. Have you got any research on the boards now that you're doing to examine this a bit further?
Well, I think that the next most important thing with comparative effectiveness research is to figure out how to, for new findings to be implemented in clinical practice. So a lot of studies, good studies that have been done, unfortunately, don't always lead to changes in how doctors practice medicine. I think the All-Hat study is a classic example. That was the NIH-funded study that looked at the appropriate first blood pressure medication that should be used, and it showed that thiazide diuretics are at least as good as any of the alternatives and obviously much less expensive. Yet many physicians continue not to use thiazide diuretics as much as they should and frequently don't use them as first-line therapy. So I think that a very important issue to look at is how do we change physician behavior based on the evidence.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Michael Hochman, I want to thank you for two things. First of all, for talking with us today, and secondly, for reading 300-plus research papers.
Thanks.
Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. You can reach Clinical Conversations at 1-617-440-4374. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for the news stories can also be found. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time, and thank you for listening.